Welcome to Coffee Time with Byron. I am your host, Byron. I just had episode 100, a milestone for me, last week. I had on former UFC fighter Nate Quarry. An awesome episode, so go check that out. We are now on episode 101. I got alongside me former NFL player Paul Moyer. Sorry. He was also now a radio analyst, still with the Seattle Seahawks. Thank you for joining us here on Spotify, YouTube, live right now. Even on Amazon Music, you can say, Alexa, play Coffee Time. I'm right there, on there, and all available podcasting apps. Thank you for joining me. How are you tonight?
Well, thanks, Byron, for having me. And segment 101 sounds pretty good. I saw your segment 100. That's a great milestone. I imagine you didn't think you were going to get there when you had number one.
Honestly, no. To be honest, no. I didn't think that. Honestly, I didn't think that this many former athletes would want to talk to a nobody like myself.
Which goes to show you how bored we are out there. No, you know, I just think the whole podcasting is, you know, for particularly my generation, it's new, right? So, you know, we all want to be a part of it as well. And
yeah,
I don't necessarily want to do my own podcast. I'd rather jump on with you guys.
Yeah, because I mean, like I said, I didn't expect to go this far, but yeah, it's like it's. I just give kudos to you guys for taking time. Yeah, I'm still having trouble getting the big names, like, you know, like the schedule and all that, and email all these people, but like the big time names and still current athletes. But for you guys like yourself, and obviously Nate Quarry, who took time as well to spend time with me, like, I mean, I give kudos to you guys, because I'm still trying to make something of this thing, to make it big, to go on radio, get myself noticed, and it's tough because I'm by myself, but I give guys like you kudos to doing this, because it helps me out a lot and I have fun doing it. This is why I do it.
Well, this goes to show you perseverance. And hey, look, this is what America started on, right? I mean, you got to start somewhere. And I think there's a lot of guys out there, you know, like myself, we're interested in people like you, Byron, who are starting these things. It also gives us an opportunity to get different type of questions. You know, if you run purely in the sports world all the time,
yeah,
you get the same questions all the time. And I find some of these podcasts, you know, it's a little more open, and you can go a lot of different directions. So, yeah, so they're fun to do.
Definitely. And again, thank you for doing it. So let's get started. I see, unfortunately, we all like to get drafted, but unfortunately, you're the one of the many that went undrafted. Thank God you were able to play, but we all like to get drafted. You went undrafted in 83 out of Arizona State. Let's get started there before I ask you about your college career. Take us through that whole drafting process. Did you get scouted by anybody? Did you talk to anybody? How different was the draft process compared to what you see this generation?
Well, I'm perseverance for me, too, because you're right. Undrafted free agents, it's definitely a tougher road. And it's probably even harder now. When I came out of Arizona State, we were the number one defense in the country that year. And I don't know how many guys got drafted, but my counterpart, a guy named Mike Richardson, who was a three-time All-American, he got most of the headlines. Even though I had 10 sacks my senior year, I led our team in the interceptions. We were the number one defense in the country. I was the East-West Shrine MVP. I had 20 tackles in the Fiesta Bowl against Oklahoma and Marcus Dupree. What happens back then that's different now is your junior day, or when you're a junior and they bring out all the pros, you know, they time you and they put you through kind of what they do now with a combine. Mm-hmm. I was hurt. I didn't play very well my junior year. I probably ran a bad 40. What I remember, the reason why I say that is, I remember after I was done playing, I went into coaching, and I went in and looked at my file, what they had on there, and they had something like a 4.7 or something, and that just sticks. So today, you get another opportunity. You didn't have the combines the way they were back then. You did know, as undrafted free agent, you had a shot. because they brought in so many guys. And for me, while I was really disappointed I didn't get drafted, because I thought the Rams, that was my hometown. Mm-hmm. Coaches from Arizona State that went there, I thought they were going to draft me. They seemed like they had the most interest. But when that, you know, went past me and I didn't get drafted, it was about midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning when the draft got done back then.
Right.
And all of a sudden the phone's ringing at 1 a.m., you know, from all the teams trying to sign.
Right. Right.
And I was fortunate because there was a guy named George Dyer. George Dyer was our defensive line coach for the Seahawks. Mm-hmm. But he was my defensive coordinator, and he was a guy who recruited me at Arizona State. So he knew me. And I was also fortunate in that while we had two really good starters in Kenny Easley and John Harris, they're both great safeties. Mm-hmm. The backups, not so much. And I thought, all right, this was Chuck Knox's first year coming in 83. I thought, new system, backups weren't that great. I got a shot at this thing. And so, you know, the rest is history. It worked out pretty well.
Now tell us about your, before we get into your career with the Seahawks, tell us about your college career at Arizona State. Obviously you said you didn't have a good junior year. Do you think that ultimately led to you not getting a shot to be eligible in the draft? Like, no team wanted you, was because of that year? And if, say, do you think your career would have been totally different if no team had took a shot on you? Do you think you would have been just a backup?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, for me, my junior year, I started my first three games. We were really good. We actually led the country in offense that year. We had some great players getting John Riggins was our running back. We led the nation
right.
In off my junior year. We led the nation in defense my senior year. So we had a really good team. But I lost confidence. I didn't play well. They benched me. Mm-hmm. The third game, I never got a chance to get back in and play. I was going to transfer and go play baseball at Cal State Fullerton. That was kind of what I thought. That I'm done with football. Mm-hmm. I went to a junior college, Fullerton Junior College, and I had three of the great mentors of all time. A guy named Hal Schierbeck, who is a legend coach, winning his coach in junior college history. Mm-hmm. Al Fiola, who was my secondary coach, and Coach Jesperson, who just passed away in the last week. And they called me, and I told them, I'm going to transfer from Arizona State, and I'm going to go to Fort and play baseball. And they said, you'll regret that the rest of your life. If you want to go play baseball, go out for Arizona State. Mm-hmm. And they did have a guy named Barry Bonds at the time, and a couple of pretty good kids. But I just got my act together. I just said, it's time to grow up. It's time to get, you know, do well in school. It's time to put an effort into football. And I just did. I was young, too. You know, I never redshirted. I was 17 when I graduated from high school. So I was, you know, a younger guy. It took a while for me to develop physically. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the light switch turned back on. I didn't even start my first game my senior year. They wanted to kind of test me. Mm-hmm. And the second game I started my senior year, I had two interceptions, two forced fumbles, two fumble recoveries, and I had about three or four games in a row like that. So I had a really good senior year. But I think that the question that you asked, did it hinder me my junior year getting drafted? No question. They want to see guys who have played.
Right.
I didn't really put an effort into working out and, you know, doing all the timing and stuff until my senior year. But again, back then you really didn't want to get drafted in the late round. You'd right. rather be an agent. You got paid just as much, your signing bonus, and you got to at least dictate where you wanted to go. So, yeah.
Now that you said baseball as your second sport, I got to ask you about that. Now, since I also ask you about how different your career would have been if you didn't go on, if you didn't go stayed undrafted, how different do you think your career would have been if you would have went to play baseball? I know you said they told you no because of a certain Barry Bonds, which obviously I have my own say about him, but I'm not going to go into that. But how well do you think you would have fared if you would have switched sports? Do you think you would have possibly made it to the majors like you would have in the NFL? Because I know that's I know it's difficult because you got to go through minors, obviously. You got to go through three. You got to go through single A, double A, and triple A. Well, I guess you could say four, low A. But you got to go through four different leagues to get to the big leagues. Do you think you would have made it to the big leagues eventually?
Well, we all think we could. It's pretty hard to hit a slider and a 98-mile-an-hour fastball. You know, maybe they didn't throw quite as hard back then. Mm-hmm. I was a pretty good baseball player in high school. I loved baseball. We all think so. I thought I could have been a professional golfer. You know, you get down to, you know, 1-2 handicap, you know, and you're playing it recreationally. Kenny Easley was the same way. You know, we said, well, if we put all of our effort into this, yes, I'm a good enough athlete, I can pull this off. Then reality hits. I went and played behind Freddie Couples, and I go, I'm not going to be a professional golfer. I'm pretty good, but I'm not going to be professional. Baseball's the same way. You think you're pretty good until all of a sudden you see guys like Barry Bonds, Odubi McDowell. Arizona State won the national championship, I think it was my sophomore year in baseball. So they were loaded. But yeah, I think I would have made it, but that's just your mindset.
Right.
I'm glad it worked out because, you know, I wouldn't have my wife, my two kids, and everybody else if I didn't go that path.
Now, once you your college career and NFL career, you were considered a safety, and no offense, but mostly safeties and cornerbacks. I don't know about back then, but I know from watching the game since the early 90s, well, late 90s, sorry, because I'm a 90s kid, growing up with the sport, that those two spots are mainly a lot, you know, so you're one in a kind, I think. A lot of those, most teams go for blacks, because that's all I see. I'm just seeing from what I see from the late 90s. Now, that was a tough position for you to play because I don't know how it was back in when you played, but was that kind of make it tough for you to play that position?
No, I mean, you know, I mean, it's just the nature of that position, and it's probably no different today. You know, most of my friends, you know, Kenny Easley, John Harris, you know, they were great mentors of mine. You know, for me, I wasn't a, you know, a 4.2, 4.3, 40 guy. You know, I was more of a 4.5,
yeah,
maybe, you know, 4.6 at the end of my career. But I knew football. I knew angles. I was a pretty smart guy. I mean, I had a, you know, 90%. I pretty much knew what was going to happen when the ball was snapped. So I knew from angles, getting good jumps, things like that. I knew being tougher than other people went a long way, you know, that in the fourth quarter you could wear people out that were faster than you. So, no, I didn't think anything of it. Plus, it was just my life, right? I mean, it's just, you know, what you grow up with. And, you know, at Arizona State, it was the same way. And then finally when I got into Seattle. But, no, didn't affect me one bit.
Now, you obviously played in the rough and tough physical era. I'm not saying it's still tough to this day, but it's less tough than what it was when you played. Now, were you one that, for your position, did you go for the ball or did you want to head honcho, knock out the quarterback for a sack? Let me rephrase that. In your mind, when you were playing on the field, what was your take? What did you wanted to go for the most, the ball or the quarterback?
Yeah, I like to think of myself as a playmaker. I was a ball hawk. I mean, I liked intercepting. I like causing fumbles and recovering fumbles. And so if I had the choice, because people have asked me, would you rather just lay a guy out coming across the middle, which you were allowed to do back then?
Mm-hmm.
I'm about to do that anymore. Or intercept a pass. there's nothing better than intercepting a pass, taking it down the sideline, you know, the 12's going nuts. It lasts longer. It looks better in the stats too. But don't get me wrong. I mean, a great hit is that's a pretty good feeling too.
Tell me if I'm right on this. But when you the year you went undrafted and you signed out of Arizona State to the Seahawks, you play all 16 games. Let's see if you remember this and who it was against. Your only interception return for a touchdown in your career. Do you remember who it was off of and where it was at?
Absolutely. It was a 19-yard touchdown. It was off Dan Fouts, and he was trying to get the ball to Kellen Winslow. So two Hall of Famers.
Yep.
I think it was the third game of the season.
Yep.
It put us a pretty good lead at that point. No, it was pretty exciting. What I do remember after that was getting beat by, I want to say, Charlie Joyner or somebody on a kind of a skinny post. So I remember that more than a touchdown. But, yeah, you never forget your first career interception.
Did you get to keep that ball?
I do. I have it somewhere. It's funny because if you come in my house, you wouldn't even know I played. I don't have anything
right.
up.
Right.
Eventually, when we get to our next house with our kids, all my kids have moved to Dallas. You know, we'll probably build something a little nicer than
like a man cave.
Have. Yeah, exactly. but right now, I don't have anything. I've got some balls. They're in storage and boxes. I actually had the bummers. I had somebody break into my storage unit, stole a bunch of them, and it over the years, people have called me or text me or DM me and said, hey, by the way, I have this football of yours that looks like it was a game football. So they kind of come back slowly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I still have that touchdown.
There you go. See, you gotta always remember that one too. Now, obviously, I saw where it was at. It was in the Kingdom, the old Kingdom. God, I miss those kind of stadiums. Growing up in the 90s, I miss those stadiums. I really do. But, I got to ask you about the crowd before we get back into your playing career. Was the crowd like it is today? Are they literally called the 12th man? Were they back then as well for you guys? Because I know you guys were still a young team. I don't know if you guys were going anywhere yet, but I know you guys had some struggles there, and you did propel. But was the crowd always there and has the 12th man like they are today?
Yes, they've been faithful. The only time they weren't really faithful, and I say that lighthearted, was kind of the Ken Bearing years in the mid '90s until Paul Allen purchased the team,
mm-hmm.
And then they ramped up again in '99, and it's really been that way ever since. It was a different kind of loud, though. And we had the wave going, and we had multiple waves. It was a piercing noise as well in the Kingdom. It was deafening. You could not hear. I could be right next to you screaming next in your ear, and you couldn't hear me.
Right.
I used to tape the little holes in our helmets. Dave Wyman says, well, that doesn't work. Well, actually, it did. It just took the muffle away a little bit there, but it was so loud it hurt. Today, with Lumen Field, it's super loud. It's college atmosphere. They stand the whole time, but it's more of a natural sound. So you can have a conversation. You can hear a little bit, even though it's cool, loud, and it gets you fired up. The Kingdom was louder, and partly because of the cement. I think the pride of the 12s. Back then it was 12th man. Today it's 12s.
Yeah.
But, you know, look, you can go back to the very first game they played. Man, this is a football town. And they support the Seahawks.
Now, do you think that ultimately, like you said, it was deafening when you played? Do you think that helped you as a player, or do you think it kind of tormented you guys has at times to where you guys lost some, well, I'm not going to say most, but at least half of your games? Did it help? Do you think the crowd helped you guys? Because usually the home team, usually the home team crowd helps the home team. But with that noise and that loudness, does that actually help?
Yeah, good question. And we had – my first year was 83. That's the first year we went to the playoffs. We went to the AFC Championship game and lost to the Raiders that year.
Mm-hmm.
We had a good run, 83, 84, 86. We had a really good team, 87, 88. We won the AFC West, went to the playoffs. Here's what I'll tell you about that. Yeah, it helped because our defensive line, you know, we had Jacob Green, Rufus Porter, Joe Nash, Jeff Bryant, you know, some really good pass rushers back then. Mm-hmm. And their get-off was crazy. And so as a secondary, we kind of were like watching a video game. You know, we're backing up. We're playing Elway. Elway's running for his life. We're just saying, don't give up the deep throw. It definitely helped. But every once in a while, and that one in particular, 1986, we're playing the New York Giants the year they won the Super Bowl. And we mm-hmm. beat them that game. But there was a play where Terry Taylor, our left corner, and myself was in, and Terry yelled something to me. I didn't hear him. I kind of looked at him like, yeah, whatever. You know, you got deep third. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm dropping down to, you know, play more of a outside the linebacker position. And next thing I know, I see their quarterback throw a fade for a touchdown. And I look at Terry. I go, what? And he goes, I gave you basically a call where he would be rolled up and I would go over the top. And I said, Terry, you never make those calls. I make those calls. Mm-hmm. But we couldn't hear each other, and there was a bit of a battle there, and he's a good friend of mine. We got through that. But those are the things, just communication. Everything was hand signals. You dumbed it down a little bit on defense, but my goodness, the get-offs and the adrenaline more than outweighed any negative to playing at home with that crowd.
Now, tell us about, I know obviously this game will remember you because obviously it's the first interception of your career and only one for a touchdown. What do you remember most besides that that Chargers game, 34-31? Yeah, like you said, you were up ahead, and then you guys blow it to Dan Fouts and Kellen Winslow, two Hall of Famers. What else do you remember most about that game? What happened? Why do you think you guys collapsed?
Well, they were pretty good, right? I mean, that was Air Coryell. They threw a ton. We end up winning that game, though, and what I remember the most about it was because San Diego had a really good team. I mean, they had Chuck Muncy, who was a running back. They had Charlie Joyner. They had Jefferson. They had Kellen Winslow, Dan Fouts, and they were loaded on offense.
Yeah.
But after we beat them, because we had lost our first game, I can't remember who we played. I want to say either Kansas City or St. Louis back then. Won the next game, I want to say, against the Jets or the Browns, somebody. And then we came home and we played San Diego. When we beat them, I think we – and Chuck Knox said, okay, now you guys need to believe because we are talented. And mm-hmm. we did have a lot of talent. We had a lot of high draft picks from Kenny Easley, Jacob Green, Kurt Warner. I mean, we had Steve Largent. I mean, we had some really good football players.
Right.
That was kind of our first – okay – we believe we can beat good football teams and we can match up with some of these Hall of Famers.
The very, I'm not going to say next game, but also I'm going on to the next game. See if you remember this. Late in the fourth quarter of your 1986 game at New England in their Sullivan Stadium. What do you remember? Do you remember this? You had a blocked punt in the end zone for a touchdown. What do you remember about that play? What was going through your head? And take us through that. What was that play like? What was being called on in that situation?
Well, I don't like to bring it up too much because I got lucky on this one. But I remember we were down big time. We were at New England. We were a really good team that year. We started off 5-2 in 1986. Mm-hmm. And I remember the game because we were probably down 21 points going into the fourth quarter or late in the third, and the block punt tied the game, and we had a block designed for me and Patrick Hunter to try and get in up the middle and block the punt. I came and I kind of tripped on one of the linemen's foot. He just kind of stuck his foot out just enough to just trip me. Mm. I think Patrick got in clean. He blocked it. I'm kind of trailing five or six guys. The ball's bouncing around the end zone. And all of a sudden, this perfect bounce right back to me. And, you know, I do my best Michael Jordan vertical leap and gave some fist pumps to New England, their crowd. And then I think that we stopped them after that. And then we threw like an 80-yard touchdown to Butler. and won the game. It was one of the most fun games winning, because when we left the game, I'll give you a little tidbits on this. When we left, back then in Foxborough, it was like a 2-lane highway all the way back to the freeway. And it's terrible. I mean, the traffic's bad.
Right.
There was like one little convenience store, and Chuck Knox told the buses to pull over, gave me and a couple guys, you know, a few $100 back then, which is probably closer to $1,000.
Right.
He said, go clear the beer, you know, section out. Bring as much beer as you can on this bus, all the buses and planes. We're gonna basically have a good time on the way home. We did. We cleared the whole thing out. And that's not something Chuck did often, but special wins, that one. There's another one that maybe we'll talk about. That was pretty memorable.
Yeah, because like you said, once you down much in that game, and I think according to this, you tied it at 31, and you ended up winning it last minute. So that's saying something. I mean, I know New England wasn't good at the time, but still, regardless, that's a big comeback win. I mean, it takes not only just a collapse, but also, I mean, it takes skill to come back, because you got to maneuver. I mean, you got to say there's. I know you got to say there's at least skill involved. I know it's a collapse, but you also got to say there's got to be skill involved in that when you come back from that down that far.
Yeah, they had some good players. I'm trying to remember all their offensive guys, but I think they had Grogan was their quarterback. Man, they had a really fast wide receiver. But look, anytime you went on a road and come back double digits on the road, that's a good win. Mm-hmm. And they're hard to win. I mean, you know, if you can go 5-3 on the road nowadays, I guess you could go 6-3, depending on how many home games you got and how many road games. Man, you just don't take them for granted. And it's the best feeling in the world. I mean, it's nice to win at home because you get the crowd you get to celebrate with. Mm-hmm. But most of the time is once the game's over at home, you kind of disperse. You end up with your families, you go to dinner, but you're not hanging out as a group. You got the road game, man, you got the bus ride back. You're jumping on a plane that's, in that particular case, is probably a 6-hour flight. And actually, that one we might have had back in the day, because the fuel, you couldn't go cross country back then unless you got a big 747.
Right.
We'd have to stop like in Spokane, or we would stop, you know, in Minnesota and refuel. So it was a long trip. I remember that. But and those, again, I'll take a great road win over a great home win any day because of those memories.
Now, like you said, you obviously got to play some in some playoff games. Tell us about that experience. What is playoff football like compared, obviously, to the regular season? I know it's a big difference, but you lived it playing in the playoffs. How exciting is it to play in the playoffs compared to, I mean, because it's a one game elimination. I know you didn't manage to play in any other sport, which is like a 7-game series. But you lived it with one where elimination is after one game. If you lose, you're out. So what was that like playing in that kind of atmosphere, and how exciting was it for you as a player?
Yeah, it's pretty intense, and you've heard these stories. I mean, there's preseason. Yeah, you're fired up. Then there's the regular season, and, you know, it's obviously a very physical, intense game. And then you get to the playoffs, and it's just another level. I guess the best way for me to compare it is the playoffs kind of turned more like college games at that point, because college games, you couldn't lose. I can remember every one of my losses in college,
right?
Every one.
Right.
I can't remember my losses in the NFL because, yeah, they're important, and it's like going to a funeral the next day when you show up at the facilities. But that's where the playoffs turns into more college, because you know you only got one game and it's over, and it is intense. And the very first playoff game, we played the Denver Broncos in a wild card game. That in itself, by the way, 83. We had to win our last two or three games in a row to get to the playoffs, and they were kind of interesting. One was against the Giants, Well, actually, one was against Kansas City. I think we won 51-48 in overtime.
Mm-hmm.
And then we played the Giants. And I wanted to say they scored a touchdown at the end of the game, but called it back because of holding, or we wouldn't have gone to the playoffs. And then we played New England in 83, the last game of the year at home. Winner goes as a wild card, mm-hmm. and we blew them out. So now we're on a roll. Now we're feeling pretty good. But then we got Denver, first playoff game. Elway wasn't starting. I think they had Steve DeBerg was a quarterback. Elway came in late, but we blew them out. And then we went to – and that was fun because the crowd was just – they were crazy. And I remember I did an autograph signing session sometime in the middle of the week. Mm-hmm. It was at South Center. There was probably 4,000 people wrapped around the whole mall, through the mall, waiting for me and another guy. I don't remember who it was. I'm like, right. This is crazy. Right. I mean, that's how, you know, fanatic it was. Then we went to Miami and beat Dan Marino. We are huge underdogs. And that's the game most people remember with the Seahawks, the big moment. And then got our butts kicked pretty good by the Raiders in the AFC Championship game. But no, it's another level. I was fortunate probably to play in 6 or 7 playoff games. And yeah, it's a different feeling.
Now I'm going to put you on the spot here because obviously it was before my time. I was in obviously 90s, but it was before my time. I got to ask you, you like you said, you had good teams. And obviously you ran into some powerhouses. Why do you think you guys ultimately couldn't win the Super Bowl? What led to that? What was the number one reason you think you guys couldn't win the Super Bowl?
Well, I would have 84, we started off 12-2. We won 8 games in a row. And we had a great defense that the really for 84, 85, 86, some really good defenses. I think we had 63 turnovers that we forced in 1984. I think it's an NFL record still to this day. I had 37, 38 interceptions. We had one game where we returned 4 touchdowns off interceptions against Kansas City in 84. So we were really good, but we lost the first game of the year. I think we were playing Cincinnati or Cleveland, and Kurt Warner, our running back, blows his knee out.
Mm-hmm.
And that was tough because we were ground shock. We were built to run the football, play action, hit Steve Largent. And now we didn't have a running game. We had to throw it a ton. And throw it we did. And we were really good. We went on a huge roll. And unfortunately, by the time we got to the end of the year, we lost our last 2 games. We just didn't have an offense. You know, we couldn't run the football. We couldn't protect Dave Craig. Offensive line struggled. So that was the biggest reason, because that's when we had most of our good players. You know, they were still young. We had a lot of, you know, first-round picks that were pretty high. And then our next great team was 86, and we got on a roll. We won our last 5 games of the year. We finished 10-6, and we probably could have won the Super Bowl that year. We beat Denver at the end of the year, blew them out like 44-10. We beat the Giants that year, and those were the 2 teams that ended up in a Super Bowl. But we didn't make the playoffs. We got beat on a tiebreaker.
Mm.
And that was tough. 88, we won the NFC West. We had a good team, but we had to go on the road. And we played Cincinnati that year. They had Icky Woods and Boomer Esiason. We had a good team. We were good, especially at the end of the year. We just couldn't quite overcome the mistakes. We fumbled, I think, 2 times inside the 5-yard line. We would have beat them. I would have liked to have a shot that year because I thought we were pretty talented also.
Now, take us through the locker room that time when you lived it and you guys were going through those playoff runs. Obviously, like you just said, you ran through powerhouses and it wasn't your guys' fault. It wasn't the coach's fault. But do you think there was also, after all that, do you think there was tension between the players and the coaching staff because you guys couldn't reach the ultimate plateau of Super Bowl, which ultimately led to the downfall of the Seattle Seahawks after you left?
Yeah, I think it's just our time was 83, 84, 85, 86. 87, we got Brian Bosworth that year. And we actually, coming off of 86, most of the experts picked us to win the Super Bowl going into 87.
Mm-hmm.
But we had the strike. We've got Brian Bosworth, Dave Wyman, and I'm forgetting Woods' first name. We drafted three linebackers that year. And the chemistry wasn't quite right in 87. The strike there, Steve Largent and Jeff Kemp crossed the picket line. That was really hard for us who didn't. Mm-hmm. Look, we all respected each other. We had good open conversations, but I did think it pulled the locker room apart, and it took us another year to kind of get it back together. We ended up trading Kenny Easley after that year. He ended up having a kidney ailment that ended up retiring. But I just think those were the years, and it's hard. We're going up against John Elway, great quarterback. You had San Francisco with Joe Montana, great teams. The Redskins were really good. The Raiders had some really good teams. It's just, we just couldn't quite pull it off. And then now you get into 89, 90, 91. Now we're old. Yeah. Now we got to get rid of Dave Craig and Kurt Warner. And Kenny Easley was gone. And Jacob Green was towards the end of his career. And it was time to rebuild. So, when you have those windows, you got to jump at it. And hopefully you can pull it off. We just weren't able to do it.
Now, in 88, you started all 16 games and led the team with 6 interceptions. Unfortunately, though, a neck injury ended your career in 89. So did you know then and there you were done? You were finished as a player? Or did you want to continue to try and play even after the neck injury? Because I know you guys were rough and tough back then, just like they are now.
Yeah.
Just like they are, well, still to this day, the players are, don't get me wrong, even though they still baby the sport now. But yeah, I still think some players are still tough to this day. But back then it was even tougher, like yourself. Did you know then and there you had to call it quits after that injury?
Well, 88, that was a good year for me, by the way. I should have had 10 interceptions. I dropped a couple, 2 of them. I had 2 of them called back, so that kind of fired me up. But that's another story. In 89, I was getting stingers a bunch. And my daughter was just born November 1st. And I played the game. So it was on a Wednesday she was born. That Sunday we were playing the Cleveland Browns, and I got knocked out cold. I mean, when I say knocked out, like 2 minutes, 3 minutes, snoring. Had to come back from a couple commercials, the old smelling salt that they give you. And, I didn't know where I was. I didn't even remember my daughter was born.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had some x-rays, and I had a couple of herniated discs in my neck. And Chuck Knox was the one who kind of made it easy. He said, look, you could probably have surgery and keep playing. I don't think it's worth it. You've had a good career. We'd like for you to start, coaching. If you want to coach, why don't you join our staff? The coaches like you. Again, I had no idea they thought that way about me.
Right.
So that made it a really easy transition because I knew what I was going to do. All right. So the last 5 games of 89, I basically retired, but I went into the meetings. I traveled with them. I was up in the press box. And then I ended up coaching with them for 5 years after that.
Yeah, tell us about that. How difficult was it? You obviously played it and you were a safety coach. How tough was it to coach those guys? Knowing that you wanted to be on the field, but you couldn't. How tough was it to actually be a safeties coach? I mean, and get those guys ready for games? Because I know it had to hurt you because you wanted to be on the field.
Well, it was a good transition for me, right? Because I got to kind of wean myself off of being a football player, that adrenaline rush.
Mm-hmm.
And coaching is every bit the adrenaline rush. It's different in that, you live and die by wins and losses. It doesn't matter how good I coached. If we lost, you felt horrible because your job, was dictated by wins and losses. The hard part for me, Byron, was getting the respect from the guys I played with that now I'm their coach.
Right.
And
yeah.
One of them was Eugene Robinson. And Eugene and I talked about it. He said, I know more than you do. Basically, how are you coaching me? He didn't say that to me, but he made reference in a couple articles until I taught him a couple of things. And his first time he made the Pro Bowl was when I was the secondary coach. He had 9 picks, and I was doing everything to get him in the positions to make plays.
Right.
And I gave him, he talks about this, it's a 7 route. a corner route, and when you play two deep zone, there's a way to actually intercept that ball, but you cannot look at the receiver. You've got to look at the quarterback, and you got to break on the quarterback, because the quarterback actually makes that throw before the receiver makes his break.
Right.
And once Eugene got that, he would intercept that all the time. And so I had to give them things to make them better to get, you know, their respect. And so it's hard. It's hard to go from a player to a coach on the same team. It took me probably 3 years before I felt like, all right, they really know, I know what I'm doing.
Now, obviously, I got to ask you then, you personally, you even though you had that cup of tea coaching, did you ever think about wanting to be an actual head coach? Advance up? Like, tell us about that, because you said you were a coach for 5 years. Did you have your thoughts of wanting to maybe be a head coach?
Yeah, I mean, that was the goal. You know, I was kind of on a fast track early in my career because we, in 1992, Tom Catlin was our defensive coordinator. The late Rusty Tillman, actually, I've lost both of them now. They both have passed. Great coaches. Tom Catlin's one of the best coaches I've ever been around. And so he was mentoring me hard, and we had a great defense that year. Lousy team. One of the worst offenses in the history of the NFL. Matter of fact, probably the worst offense in the history of the NFL that we got to play with. But defensively, we finished eighth in the league. We were number two in third down conversions. We did a lot of cool things. So, yeah, so I was on a bit of a fast track. But then we basically all got fired. Tom Flores got fired. They brought in Dennis Erickson. He had a secondary coach at the time, so there really wasn't an opportunity there. And I had to make a tough call. I had two young kids. My wife was from here. And I said, well, you know, do I move them around every 3 years or do I try a different career? And I ended up trying a different career. It's been good for me. I still get to be a part of the Seahawks in some form. But it's hard to walk away from something that you love to do. But, you know, I kind of like the family and kids more than coaching.
So now I got to ask you this. If you remember, obviously you had – I see this. You had four sacks in your career. Do you remember who your sacks were off of?
I can remember almost every interception because I've intercepted John Elway, Dan Fouts, Jim Kelly, Phil Sim. I got some Hall of Famers in there. I don't remember any sack. I can't remember them. I'll go back every once in a while and look at statistics, which is kind of weird because they didn't keep official tackles like they do
today. They didn't,
Even though I can go and actually pull the game play-by-play, which they wrote, you know, in pencil and pen, you can go get those. I just don't remember blitzing that much.
Yeah, I don't think they kept stats for sacks until, like, what, late 80s, I think?
I want to say it might have been around my first year or maybe the year before because Jacob Green – I don't think they counted his first couple of years. He would end up having more. But we didn't blitz a bunch. But I had 10 sacks my senior year at Arizona State. So, yeah. I mean, I knew how to get after a quarterback when the opportunity. I just don't remember any of those four.
Who would you have liked to, even though you don't remember, and you may have sacked these guys, I don't know. But who would you have wanted to sack? Because it's a who's who of Hall of Famers, like you said. Fouts, Marino, Elway. I mean, come on.
Oh, it's John Elway. John Elway. And the reason why for John, and I played against him at Stanford. I had an interception on him. I don't know if I had a sack our senior year. Mm-hmm. I played with him in the East-West Shrine game. I played against him twice every year with Denver and then one time in the playoffs. So he's by far the most quarterback I've ever faced and had some success with him. And matter of fact, I did sack him because I have a picture of a sack with.
There you go. Chuck. See, I brought back. There you go.
Yeah. So he's the one. I mean, I still think he's one of the greatest, if not greatest, of all time because he won even when they didn't have good teams, and that to me is, you know, the mark of a great quarterback.
Well, that's kind of who's who too, because I mean, you say that about him, I do too, but. There's another guy that played, I just said, a lot of people say he's the GOAT. Well, he could have been, but just never won any playoffs or Super Bowls. I think you know who I'm talking about, and you played against him in the South. You know who I'm talking about.
Are we talking Dan Marino?
Yes. A lot of people are saying he was top of the line. And I saw him play in the late at the end of his career before he retired. And he was one of the greatest, I thought. He just could never play. He just could never win the playoffs for some reason. I just don't get it. I don't understand it.
Yeah, it was. He had the quickest release.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yep. He was light years ahead with his release, compared to any quarterback at that time. I don't know why. They had good teams. The year we beat them in 83, they had a good team. But Dan Marino's a rookie that year. That was the year of all the great quarterbacks with Elway and Marino and I think Kelly and Blackledge.
Kelly,
all those.
Yep.
The next year, I think they made it to – they beat us in 84. We had to go back there, play them again. They beat us. They were ready for us that time. I think they got to the Super Bowl, didn't win it. So they had good teams, and then at the end, I think their defense just started to fade. You know, they didn't have that supporting cast. But, look, I played against, you know, Joe Montana, you know, Dan Marino, Jim Kelly, John Elway. Dan Fouts. I mean, that's some pretty good company right there. And they all had good teams, too. You know, just, you know, John was the one, though, that didn't matter what year it was. They were always a threat with John Elway.
So now I'm going to put you on the spot here, okay? Let's see if you can do this. You played safety, so I got to ask you, give me your top five safety players in the history.
Oh. Yeah, well, I'm gonna put Kenny Easley at the very top just because I played with him and when he was healthy.
That's a good one.
He's
in my top five.
He was. I put Ronnie Lott in there. I put Ed Reed. You know, part of me wants to go back even farther with somebody like Krause, who was awfully good, you know, way before you would have known. But I think he had, you know, 63 intercepts or whatever the number, just a crazy number.
Right.
Trying to think who else. You know, he's not going to be considered one of the five great ones of all time, but he's the best I've ever seen at what he did. And it's Cam Chancellor. Cam,
I can't disagree with you there.
Now, look, did he have a lot of interceptions? Were you going to put him in a two deep zone? Were you going to put him against some fast guys, you know, coming out of the backfield and receive? No. But, man, from a guy who can intimidate a game and disrupt a game, boy, I tell you what, he's as good as they come. There's Troy Polamalu, another fun guy. God, there's a lot of good ones, that's for sure.
Now, tell me about this. Obviously, you played in Seattle. You had a dome at the time, so you didn't get to play in the snow like nowadays Seahawks do. But obviously, I know you played in the snow. So what would you say was one of your best games you ever had in the snow? Because it's very tough to play in the snow, obviously, with the weather and the snow. It's like a blizzard atmosphere. I get that. So what would you say was your top game that you had in the snow?
Yeah, I mean, look, I played in the AFC West and I went to Arizona State. So the weather wasn't too bad. The coldest game I ever played in was at New England. And it was 1988, and it was blowing about 40 miles an hour. It was probably 34 or 35, 32 degrees, but they had a wind chill factor like of 10. That was hard. I mean, you could not wait to get to the benches that were heated and get your hands and feet in there and keep your, you know, the pads would harden so much. You couldn't even take your helmet off.
Yeah.
It was too hard to get back on. But I just remember how windy that was. Doug Flutie was their quarterback. Nobody could throw the ball more than 20 yards. You know, I mean, it was that kind of wind. It wasn't going north or south. It was just a swirling. You threw the ball. It didn't matter which side. It just went straight to the ground. So that was tough. Cincinnati was another one. I think that was 1989. And it was just kind of had freezing rain. You know, little snow, but more freezing rain. So I never had the 2 feet of snow. I just never got to Green Bay or Cleveland, some of those places. So I don't have a good story for you.
No, no worries on that. Hey, no worries. So now I got to ask you about your gig that you had. Now, like we said, I think you still have it on the radio. Tell us about that. I mean, how excited are you? I mean, obviously you lived through the Russell Wilson years, and now you're going to deal with, obviously, a rebuild, obviously. So what are you looking forward to? I mean, you had a good team when you had a good team in Russell Wilson all the years, didn't do nothing. You had that one Super Bowl, and now you're going to rebuild. What are you looking forward to with the Seattle Seahawks team?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to them just being young and hungry again and getting guys who love to play the game. And it's not that they don't now. I look at Russell Wilson and Bobby Wagner. They're the last two holdovers from the Super Bowl teams.
Yep.
It's not that they don't love it. It's just that they have other interests now. They have families. They have outside business engagements going on. They have people, you know, that they're meeting with from an investment standpoint. They're still showing up. They're still working. But there's only one guy I know that really, into the, his age, that continues to put football number one at all costs, is Tom Brady. I mean, you don't – he's got –
I can't deny that. Yeah, that's true.
But the focus is still there. So I think for me, it's just getting guys who are just hungry. You know, just want to – football first no matter what. And hopefully it's not a negative on Bobby or Russell. You know, great players. And, you know, again, we all wish them well. But it was time. It was time because they're complaining, and you know their play had dropped a little bit. They're the highest paid guys, and if you're gonna be the highest paid guys, you better play like the highest paid guys. And so I just feel like we're gonna have that bring back, compete at all costs. Last year, and maybe even the last 2 years, I didn't see us develop the younger guys. They didn't get on the field like they used to 10 years ago. I mean, Richard Sherman got on the field, Bobby Wagner, KJ Wright, you know, and even some other guys they sprinkled in, even if they got 10 to 15 plays just to get that feel for the speed of the game. So I'm looking forward to that. I think the talent is actually there. Byron's telling you, there's no way that Pete and John Schneider, Pete Carroll, are going to say it's a rebuild year. They don't believe that. They think it is a retool year. I get, look, we don't have a quarterback that everybody will acknowledge as a Pro Bowler or the guy yet. Let's let it play out. But I do think we have more talent on the team this year than in the last couple of years. So I think it'll be fun.
So let's bring out the analyst in you. Who do you think ultimately wins that trade, Broncos or Seattle? Because you got some you got some good pieces in that trade. I like some of the pieces. Noah Font's a good tight end, and you that, and you got that good. Can't think of his name right now. I think he's either a linebacker or a defensive end.
That we got Harris, a defensive tackle.
Yes. So you've got two good players in that trade. And, yeah, I know he's not the best quarterback, but, I mean,
we'll see. Let's give him a chance.
I mean, he's has shown talent. So, I mean, ultimately, let's play the analyst here. Who do you think will ultimately win that trade?
Well, I think there's a short-term, long-term to this, right? I think short-term, Denver looks like their team is ready and just needed that quarterback. I'm curious to see what kind of offense they run with Russell, because we brought in Shane Waldron last year to really have this quick game, screen game, crossing routes. You know, Russell just that type of offense doesn't play well for Russell. He can't see over the lineman to really work the middle of the field. And it's why he does hold the ball so long. At the same time, he creates huge plays from it. So, you know, it's that give and take constantly. So I'm curious to see what Denver does with it. But they look like their team's ready. And then you throw in Russell Wilson. I think short term, maybe they win this. But long term, we're going to get at least 7 starters out of this deal, right? We got 3 right now, just from the players that we got from Denver, and then throwing 2 first-round picks, 2 second-round picks. Those are going to be 4 starters. Who knows what else we do to package it? I mean, you're talking seven starters for one guy. And not just that, that one guy makes more money than all seven of those guys combined.
Right.
You know, Russell Wilson. So what we learned is it's really hard to win with a max contract that's a quarterback. I'm not telling anything that everybody doesn't know. And never take a step back. You know, never rebuild. The Seahawks have never rebuilt. I mean, they've always gone to the playoffs. We've always won. We've always had the 25th, 26th, 30th pick, you know, in the first round.
Yeah.
I just think this is where John Schneider and Pete like to be. I also think, look, Pete's been with us for 10 years. The message gets old after a while with anybody. Doesn't matter. You know, I mean, could be the greatest speaker in the world, the best guy, best, you know, any relationship. After 10 years, you get tired of hearing the same thing. So it's good to get new, fresh faces in where Pete's message, I think, will resonate and people will try and run through the wall again for him. So I'm excited. I actually think we're going to be a pretty good team. How good's going to dictate, you know, we got to have the quarterback play pretty well.
Now that you mentioned that, I got to ask you about the message, as you said. Do you think that's ultimately what happened between Russell Wilson and Pete Carroll and the Legion of Boom? Because that's obviously no more. He's got to rebuild that and make a new Legion of Boom. And obviously, it's a two-part question. Between that and the what the hell? I'm still wondering, as much as fans are, even you got to be baffled, the freaking call that blew the Super Bowl for them. Do you think that's what ultimately led to Russell Wilson and the Legion of Boom ending? Yes, I get they're old, and they were getting older, but do you think that's what ultimately led to them leaving, was because the owner didn't want to fare away from Pete Carroll because of what Pete Carroll has done? But you got to look, it was the Legion of Boom and Russell Wilson that brought that whole Seahawks to what they were.
Well, I'll start with the Legion of Boom. It was just time. You know, Richard had some injuries. You know, he wasn't the player he was. It was time. Earl Thomas, you know, it was same. I think we probably could have kept him another year or two. I don't think his skills had diminished that much at that point.
Yeah.
But the way it finished with him being pretty derogatory towards the coaches and injury. And, you know,
that's just the same. Yeah.
Yeah. As far as Russell and Bobby Wagner, you know, why did we let him go? He was due $18 million. I know he made the Pro Bowl last year, but he wasn't our best linebacker last year. You know, he's still a good player, but he's a top 15 player now. He's not the top two or three linebacker in the league anymore. And New England would have cut him 3 years ago, right? Right when somebody gets to their peak, gets that contract, you know, it's time for them to get younger. The Seahawks have it. They've rewarded and been loyal to, you know, the guys who helped them win. I think that's great. Russell didn't want to, he wasn't going to sign an extension. He made that very clear to them. So now what are they going to do? They just decided that, all right, now's the time. We can still probably get some pretty good draft capital, which they did, and some players. We can free up some cap room. We can sit there and see, is our system good enough to win without a bona fide Hall of Fame Pro Bowl quarterback? And I think that's where the difference was. Russell wanted to be thought of as Tom Brady, Aaron Rodgers. Mm-hmm. I can win, throw the football.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you can. But you're better at us running the football, play action it, and then taking shots downfield. That is where we are at the best, running the football, playing great defense. Doesn't mean you can't win with him throwing it. So now you just have a difference of philosophy. And that's what it came down to. And, you know, the ownership, Jody Allen, I think, you know, she probably talked with Russ. I wasn't in a room, but she clearly gave the green light that go ahead and seek a trade.
Now, what do you think was ultimately the ultimate decision? Who came up with that ultimate decision in that Super Bowl? Because that's an ultimate collapse in my book. I'm not saying Atlanta is a collapse. Well, because that is awesome. That is one of the biggest collapses. But to me, though, you have one of the best all-time running backs, and Marshawn Lynch, who's a powerhouse, at the one freaking yard line, who was dominant for you throughout the whole season and seasons that he was with you, and you freaking go for a pass on the 1 yard line to freaking Malcolm Butler, who ends up picking it, and look what happened to him in the following or a couple Super Bowls later, being benched by freaking Belichick. I mean, who ultimately made that freaking decision? I mean, that had to be one of the all-time collapses for you, honestly, as in Seahawks history.
Well, the ending was certainly a tough one. What was really tough was my wife, who I met, she was a Seahawks cheerleader when I met her. Mm-hmm. My daughter was a Seahawks cheerleader for that game, too. So she's down in the Super Bowl in Arizona, and we're thinking this is going to be one really happy Moyer family when this is all said and done. Mm-hmm. I don't have a problem with them throwing on second down, and here's why. Well, first of all, we were lucky to just be there. You know, Jermaine Kearse made a great catch to get us down there at the time. Or we almost scored the play before. It's first down. Marshawn hits one on the left side. He's in, but their linebacker comes out of nowhere and makes a really good hit on him and gets him down to the 1 yard line. We have one timeout left. Mm. There's 30 seconds left in the game. So now you go, how do I get 3 plays out of this with one timeout? Well, the first one you go, I'm going to throw it, right? And if it's incomplete, that's fine. The second one, you can run it or throw it. I got a timeout. And then the third one, you know, if it's fourth down, you just, you know, you do whatever is your best play. The reason that what I didn't like about that play, it wasn't the pass. Matter of fact, statistically, they should have thrown the football. Mm-hmm. But the slant route that they did, and they stacked it, and as soon as they did the 3-step drop and did a slant, I went, uh-oh. And the reason why I said uh-oh, and you can hear me when I was filming it, it's because I worry about tip balls there. Malcolm Butler made an unbelievable play. They had scouted him. They knew that play. They'd seen it. We didn't execute it. We needed to get a rub on Butler, a better rub on him. We didn't do it. It just wasn't executed very well. I would have rather seen them do sprint right option. The old San Francisco and Dallas Cowboy one, when they rolled out Joe Montana and he hit Dwight Clark in the end zone. I'd have liked to have seen Russell roll out to his right with an option. You can run it, you can throw it, or throw it away. Now we've got a timeout. We're going to run the ball, give it to Marshawn, or throw it again. I don't care. We got a timeout. But we're going to get the Marshawn the ball now for one more time. If we ran the ball on second down and didn't get in, we've got to call a timeout at that point. Now if we're either going to run it or throw it, but more than likely we only got one play left, right? Mm-hmm. And so I just think it actually was the right call. I just didn't like the play choice.
Who do you think was to blame ultimately for that, Carroll or Wilson? Because I know the quarterback can change the play, and the ultimate decision does supposedly lie on the coach. So out of those two, ultimately, who made the wrong decision?
Well, I think it was the execution of the play. Daryl Bevel was our offensive coordinator. He's the one who, you know, look, they scout that, right? I mean, you're 2 weeks. They have a play down the goal line they think's going to work. And it should have worked. I mean, if we rub it and get the right release and make Malcolm not be able to come over the top like that, we got a touchdown. But Bevel made the call. I mean, Pete obviously didn't say no. Russ was the one who didn't check out of it. He's the one who made the throw. So whose fault is it? Whoever had the football last. I mean, in theory, it's Russell's, right? But I ain't blaming anybody. Really not.
Because it could have happened to anybody, yeah. It could have happened to anybody.
And, you know, it was an unfortunate ending because it ended so sudden. It was like watching Ozark at the very end. What just happened?
Now, I got to ask you, though, because this was happening a few years ago where this obviously came up. A lot of analysts were doing this and saying this. Were you a part in saying this, too, on the radio side? Who came up with this? What? Russell Cook. Who came up with that? And what the hell was all behind all that anyway?
Well, I think the let Russell Cook thing might have been Russell. God, you know, I need Dave Wyman on this one. He would know. you know, part of it was one of the coaches saying something in the off season, and you know, they did. They let him throw it early. It was 2 years ago, and he threw it early and often, and we had unbelievable success for 6-7 games. I mean, we're on a historic pace to score points. And then they learned something. And, you know, one of the things that is a challenge for Russ is teams started dropping back and said, hey, we're going to flood the players in zone coverages. We're going to make Russ have to find an open receiver. And he's not as tall, so he's got to step into the lanes. We got to create lanes for him to see and step into. And he just didn't have as much success. I think there was a statistic I was looking at. I think they only blitzed Russ 27% last year. And his quarterback rating was like 120 when they blitzed him. Well, that's because he can see it. He only has to go to one side, and it's a one-on-one situation. When they dropped people back and didn't blitz him, I think his quarterback rating was around 92 or 93, 94, 95. So big drop off there. I don't know where we got on this one. I forgot what we were talking about, but it's going to be weird not to have Russell, though.
No, it really is.
Weird.
It really, so now I got to ask you, hopefully Skip is watching this. I got to ask you, because he's a big defender of this guy, because he's from he's a big Oklahoma Sooner fan. There's a lot of talk. Even it came out of his mouth, Baker Mayfield's mouth, that the ideal situation for him, since nobody obviously wants him, and he sees the quarterback landscape, is Seattle because you got three unknowns, and he's proven himself with Cleveland. Tell us about that in the analyst in you. Is that a possibility? Because I know Carroll has said he's not looking, but he's ultimately a liar because he also said Russell Wilson wasn't going to be traded, and look what happened. So, what do you think, and the analyst in you, how different would Baker Mayfield fit as a player on your team if that ever trade happened?
Yeah, I think Baker would be. I think he'd do fine here. I think actually our system would probably work out well for him, you know, and that is, hey, Baker, we're going to have you protect the football. We're going to run it. We're going to get rid of the ball quick. We're going to play action. And I think those are all strengths of his. I just don't think we're going to do it. And I certainly didn't want us to do it before the draft. We needed to build our base back up. We needed to get some linemen. We got two offensive tackles in the draft. We needed to get some edge rushers. We got two of those. We needed to get some corners. We got a couple of those. We got a running back I didn't think we were going to be able to get. I'm really excited about Walker. I think he's going to be a stud out of Michigan State. He gives us something with – honestly, we haven't had a running back like him since I've – now we got to go back 15, 20 years. So really excited about that as well. But I just don't see Baker, unless he comes in and says, I'll do this for minimum wage, and it's all, you know, all upside. So it's all incentive-based along the way. They really want to see what Drew Locke can do. And here's why. I'm going back to the Ram offense. Shane Waldron, we pulled him from the Rams a year ago. They're crossing routes, deep crossing routes, their screen game. They work the middle of the field. That's the one area we haven't been able to do. We don't work the middle of the field. You know, Russell is an outside thrower. If you go look at his scattergram of where he throws a football. So now I got a guy who's 6'4". He's mobile. He's got a cannon for an arm. I don't need him to make every throw like Russell. I want him to make the ones that are open right now. There's a check down. It's okay to have a check down. Russell wants to extend. He wants to make the big play. And we get in some sack situations, you know, on a drive, even though maybe 6 or 7 plays look good, a couple didn't. So I just want to see what Drew Locke can do in this system. And if it doesn't work, next year's the year they go all in on a quarterback, either in the draft or through free agency. They're going to have a ton of money next year. We got a bunch of draft picks. We got 2 firsts, 2 seconds next year. You know, I think that's where you go get your quarterback.
So ultimately then, last one on the Baker thing, where do you ultimately, if it's not Seattle then, and if they want, if that is true, they want to see what they have in Locke, Smith, and Eason, where do you see Baker ultimately going, because obviously he can't go back to the Browns after that whole thing, and they've already got a full stack quarterback room with Deshaun, Brissett, and I forget the other guy. Oh, from Pittsburgh. I forget the other guy from Pittsburgh they got. Where do you see him ultimately going, or do you see him staying with Cleveland, or do you see him getting cut?
No, yeah, I don't think so. Right now, they're still trying to get, and there's, from what I've been told, they're still asking for a lot for Baker Mayfield. You know, he's on his fifth year, so he's making a ton of money, you know, as a first-round pick, fifth-year contract. You know, you actually make pretty good dough on those. If you have to trade, again, you're giving up draft capital. The Seahawks are not going to want to do that. Now, if they release him, say, okay, we're going to release him, and you can go in and grab him and redo a contract in that situation and not have to give up any draft picks, now it's a different game. But you go look around the league, I mean, there's not a lot of openings at quarterback. You know, there's a few. I mean, I think you could probably put him in Carolina still. You know, just say, hey, you know what, go ahead and compete against Darnold. You know, they did get Malik. I can't remember who they drafted.
I think they did get Malik, yes. Because the Steelers passed on him for Pickett.
Yeah, I mean, look, those quarterbacks are a year away, maybe two. You know, so Mayfield, there's some opportunities there. And I think Carolina's team's not that bad. I'm not discounting that he wouldn't be a Seahawk. I just don't think we're going to trade for him with his current contract. So right now, until Cleveland decides to let him go, you know, no one's going to know.
Now, do you agree, like Shannon Sharpe? Because Shannon Sharpe has ultimately said, even it's funny to hear them go back and forth, because I watch that show every day, and it's funny to see him and Skip go back and forth on it. He thinks he's on the verge of pretty much saying he's going to be a first-round bust, like Jamarcus Russell and Jeff George not going through their fifth-year option. Is that a possibility, too, that he ends up like them two? Because that's tough.
Are we talking about Baker?
Yes.
I think Baker still has a chance. I think Baker's a lead. I think he needs to be in the right situation. All the stuff that Baker has said, look, the number of offensive coordinators and head coaches he's had in 4 years, it's a joke. I mean, that's really hard to learn when you're constantly.
Well, yeah, it's literally a clown show over there.
It's hard. Yeah. It's really hard. So I think that is one. Two, I do think he's a leader. I think that was one of his strengths when they came out. I think that's why Cleveland picked him number one. They said he had that it factor. I think he's a playmaker, but you've got to put him in the right situation. You got to coach him up hard. And I think he would do well here. And what I mean by coach him up hard is, and this is where Pete comes into play, you are not turning the football over. That is not happening. Yeah. And Pete, I remember when Matt Hasselbeck was here, it was Pete's first year, and you know, Matt has talked about it. He goes, man, I was afraid. I was afraid to throw an interception. You know, yeah. Pete drove that home. Russell, that was his issue. Like, you know what? I want you to take some shots, but you know, not at the expense of an interception. And so I think Baker would actually do pretty well in this system.
So I got a couple more questions before I let you go. It's getting late over here on the East Coast. So the first one is, player analyst hat again. Obviously, you're in the rough and tough NFC West. I think that's the toughest division, but it's slowly being picked up now by my AFC West because I'm a Chargers fan. That's going to be a rough and tough division. Whew, they're going to beat the hell out of each other. I can tell you that right now. You're in the rough, tough division yourself. You got three good teams. You're going to be a possible possibility, too, maybe. You got the 49ers. You got the Cardinals with Kyler Murray and them. And DeAndre Hopkins, who's suspended 6 games, but still, you still got some core over there. You got the defending Super Bowl champs with Matt Stafford. Cooper Kupp, the reigning offensive player of the year. Odell's probably coming back. I mean, you got a rough and tough division. As an analyst yourself, how is that division going to play out to you this season? And who's going to come out ultimately in that division? And how many playoff teams do you see from this division?
Well, I mean, the Super Bowl champs, you know, they're the team until someone knocks them off, and they are talented. They're well coached. They've got a quarterback. You know, Beckham comes back. They've got receivers. They draft well. I mean, they do everything well. And then, you know, Aaron Donald is, I mean, he's the difference maker. I mean, he is so disruptive up the middle. Their defense is going to be tough. So I put them at number one. You know, as far as Arizona and San Francisco, look, they got a quarterback problem. You know, 2 years ago, it felt pretty good that, you know, we had four really good quarterbacks in the NFC West. And now the Seahawks, you know, we're trying to find one and have hopefully Drew Lock prove it. Mm-hmm. Murray, man, you know, he's got to step up this year. This is a big year for him. And there's a chance he does. Cause I think for the first time, they called him out and said, hey, look, you know, you've been immature. You got to be the first one here, last one leave. You got to lead to play this position. I mean, that position is demanded so much. It can't be, I'm just going to show up and I'm the most athletic guy here, which he is. He is a freak.
Right.
And he's got a pretty good arm. He's not always accurate, but he can hurt you. Their defense, though, has got a chance to be really good, too. So I'm going to put them second just because I think they have the quarterback better than San Francisco. I think the Seahawks are going to surprise people, but they might surprise me too if we don't get quarterback play. You know, so I think they will push for a playoff spot. I really do, because I think defensively we're going to be better. I think we're going to be able to run the football. I'm really excited to see what we do offensively. But if we don't get the quarterback play, I mean, that goes out the window. So I'm going to go Rams, Arizona, San Francisco and Seattle, just to see who gets better quarterback play will come out on top there.
So you ultimately see the 49ers getting rid of Jimmy G then, huh? You think that era is done?
Yeah, I just – look, he's costing him a lot of money. He's not a bad quarterback. It's just his deficiencies, everybody knows him now. So they game plan for them. You force him to throw outside the hash marks and the numbers. You know, you make him go wide. You take the middle of the field away. That's where he is. He's got a quick release, and he's very good, you know, in the middle of the field. But if you can force him to make tough throws outside, he has shown he hasn't been able to do it yet. But as far as Trey Lance goes, boy, he got a long way to go. You know, he's unbelievable athlete. When we watched him the time we played him, okay, I get why they drafted him, but now he's got to start becoming a good quarterback.
Yeah.
And he's not there yet. And look, you got to have halfway decent quarterback play to win in this league. Even as good as San Francisco is in the running game and well coached and their defense, you still got to have a pretty good quarterback play, and it's lacking from them.
So, two part question. The first part is, say this whole rebuild, I know they're not calling it that, but to me it is. If this doesn't go well, do you see Pete Carroll retiring? Do you see them firing him? And if they do fire him and he retires, who do you see his replacement? Or how long do you think he stays?
Well, he signed a new contract. The year before. I don't think he gets fired. He has a great relationship with Jody Allen, the ownership group. You know, he's well respected up here. He's got all new young faces, right? So his message is going to be, it's going to be taken pretty good. If they went 4-13 this year, there'd be some rumblings, you know, here. But it would be okay. We had a good team, but it's the quarterback play. Now if the quarterback goes off, and we struggle. That could raise a few more eyebrows. But no, he's not going anywhere. John's not going anywhere. Not for at least another couple of years, I don't believe.
Couldn't have said any better. I ask this question to everybody. This is the last remaining question. I might throw in a bonus. I don't know yet. But this is my true last remaining question. Two-part question. Obviously, I know you coached, so you pretty much answered that one, but I'll ask it to you again. If you were still coaching, when you were a coach, what did you tell your guys to get them motivated, or what would you tell the young guys to, if you were still coaching, to get to where you were? And the second part is define your career in one word.
Oh, man. The first one, look, I mean, you hear it all the time. I mean, there's no shortcuts to be great. I mean, there's very few guys who walk in and they're great and they don't outwork people. I mean, it's purely about outworking people and showing up. And it's not just showing up. I used to tell my son played football in college as well at Cal Poly. And mm-hmm. I said, look, everybody shows up for practice. Everybody shows up at the weight room. Everybody goes to class and studies. But to be great, you got to do more than that. You got to show up earlier. You got to work out twice. You got to go run when no one else is running. And so those are the big ones. For me, the way I motivated guys, I used to just come in. I would sell, we got a great game plan. We got a great game plan. I don't put you in position, you guys, to make plays. And, you know, when they start believing that, they get pretty fired up. I wasn't the guy that was going to hit a wall or anything. I'm a very emotional player, and when I was on the field as a player, I had Tourette's. I would literally curse out everybody, and I don't curse mm-hmm. in my normal life, but something about between the lines, I did. But as a coach, I tried to be pretty calm to the players, even though in the press box I was going nuts. One word to define my career. I just blessed. I mean, to do something that you love to do. Some people would say overachiever. But I don't think I was. I was a good athlete. I was a good golfer, baseball player, football player. I could play any sport. I just wasn't a world-class sprinter. And so I used to argue with people all the time. I go, just because a guy can have a 45-inch vertical and run, you know, a 4.30 doesn't mean that's a great athlete. Yeah. You know, can they shoot basketball? Are they a scratch golfer? Can they play tennis? I can do all that stuff. So that's a good question, though. Tough one to
Thank
answer.
You. I appreciate it. So now, while I have you real quick, I got to ask you, because you are an analyst, and I want to hear it from an analyst. Since I am a Charger fan, what are my odds as a Charger fan of winning the AFC West next year? With the likes of Herbert, Joey Bosa. I mean, I love Keenan Allen. I love my chances.
You got a great quarterback. Yeah, they're good. And you're right. They do remind me of the NFC West maybe 5 years ago, where you just had a bunch of great teams and quarter, maybe not even 5 years, maybe 3 years ago. You know, but you got, you know, Kansas City now, Denver, the Raiders. The LA Chargers. That's still hard for me.
With all same quarterbacks. Same. Really I grew up on the San Diego Chargers. Trust me, I know. I don't like the LA. I don't like it.
I grew up in Orange County, California. So they were, when the Rams left, they were kind of a little bit of our team, and then the Raiders came in. That was just weird. There's something about the Chargers, though, man. They've had talent for the last. Five years.
I've been disappointed every year. I know. Trust me.
Yeah.
They've given me heart attacks throughout my tenure as a fan. Literally, almost heart attacks.
But I think you got a quarterback to get it done, and you do got, you know, God, you got Bosa and company. That's
and Khalil Mack. I forgot to add that. Just signed him. Yeah.
No, you guys are loaded. No excuses. They just gotta get ready and make sure that LA is LA, but football is number one.
I agree. I couldn't have said it better. Thank you, Mr. Analyst. I thank you for your time. It was fun. I'm going to send you the episode. If you can also post that too as well. This is the audio portion. I know you posted the YouTube one, but if you can also do this one as well, I'll send it to you. It was fun. And also, if you know anybody, please send them my info. I'd love to interview them as well. If you know anybody that's interested, I'm always looking for more.
I'll let you know offline. There's a couple people you should talk to. So
perfect.
West Coast appreciates East Coast, Byron. And,
that's right. That was fun. That's right. It was fun. Thank you. I appreciate your time, and I'll definitely stay in touch with you.
You got it.
Definitely during the season, too.
Exactly.
Take care. Have a good night, all right?
All right. Appreciate it.
All right. Goodbye.